Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 3rd of January, 2012, and today I'm joined on the line all the way from the green climes of Western Ireland by Thomas Sheridan, an author and a researcher and a writer who has authored books like Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath, as well as the forthcoming follow-up to that book, Defeated Demons, Reclaiming Your Freedom from Consciousness, Parasites in Psychopathic Society, which is a mouthful and a half. He can be accessed at psychopathfree.com and also at thomassheridanarts.blogspot.com, where you can find out more about his art and his music, as well as his writings. So, Thomas Sheridan, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program today. Thanks for joining us.
Well, hi, James. Thank you for having me on. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, it is good to talk to you because I've been familiar with your work for some time now, but I haven't had you on the program yet. So I'm sure there are probably quite a few people in the audience who are familiar with yourself and your work. But for those people who haven't encountered you before, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, I grew up in Ireland. I was born in Dublin, and I grew up there during the 80s and late 70s, early 80s, when there was the economy was pretty bad, and it had its upsides too. It was really culturally, it was pretty good and things like that. I played music in bands and I had a lot of artist friends and stuff. So it was good on one level, but economically it was terrible. So the mid 80s, I had a chance to move to New York. I just went, I just left on what was basically a one way ticket. And I managed to join a band there, and then it just became my new life there. I was very happy. I was really enjoyed the buzz of the place. And then I studied graphic design. When I finished studying graphic design, I had no problem getting jobs in Wall Street firms, as there was a big demand, as marketing and PR and especially materials and public relations was really exploding within Wall Street at that time. It was a sort of a transitional time between, the old kind of old school corporate reports and a new generation that came in that was very well versed in marketing and that kind of thing. And I worked for just about all the major firms, both as a freelancer and as a staff member. And that became an incredible education for me, because not only, I was fortunate in the sense that even though I was working for all these Wall Street investment banks, I wasn't actually a money man. I was a graphic designer. So it was almost like on the outside looking in. So it was an objective view of financial system. And one of the earliest memories I had of one of my first jobs there was when Bill Clinton brought in his universal healthcare plan idea the night before, which was brought in with a huge amount of hullabaloo. And the next morning, I'm not going to name the bank that I was with, but I was told to design a graphic that showed a tombstone and it said Clinton's healthcare plan. And I was talking to the consultant and I said, well, how is this? How do you know this thing is going to fail? He only announced it last night on live TV. And he says, oh, no, we own him. He's just put out there for show. It's not real. There never was ever going to be a Canadian style healthcare system within the U.S. That's purely just politics. And so that was, that was naive me blown out of water, because I used to believe I was always kind of skeptical, but I thought basically politicians would never tell lies to that extreme. But, yes. And most of the client at the time, there was a lot of privatization going on of Central American and South American utilities, things like power stations and also the railways. The railways in England were being nationalized, privatized around that time, in Belgium as well. And that was one of the accounts I worked on. And it would just seem to me that they were just stripping national assets, privatized assets that were paid for and built up by taxpayers, and just handing them over to global corporations to just basically have them for free. It seemed to me, and it was just this beautiful scam that you build up this infrastructure over 40, 50 years that plows billions of taxpayers' money into it and then just hand it to a corporation. So it was these kind of things I learned all the time. I just assumed that the whole process was written, was generally just around greed. But there was also an element of, it was a game. You could see there was an element of almost like a sort of mind control. It was almost like sorcery. I remember the first time I heard of Edward Bernays, there was a library in one of the investment banks that had all the books I used to need. And the guy who ran the library, looked upon Bernays as a god, and he was also my boss. And it was like I suddenly realized that the world, well, not really, suddenly realized, but that we basically lived in this gigantic illusion that there's, what we think is politics is not politics, what we think is money is not money. And it was a wonderful experience on some levels, but on other levels made me very negative and disheartened. So I fell into this kind of cynical trap. And while I was working for one bank one day, I was always found that those strange individuals were drawn to these middle management positions in these jobs. Glib, superficial, always bringing me in things, buying me things. If they wanted to work me late at night, they would bring in like Chinese food and beer, but it didn't seem like very friendly. It seemed very kind of, I was being bought or something like that. And it was one of these guys in particular, was a young guy, quite a young guy. And I've told the story many times, but it turns out he was from a very wealthy Manhattan family, and he was a wild teenager, drove his family crazy, and he had went to a psychiatric evaluation, and he scored the highest level of the psychopathology test back then for a socialized psychopath. At the time, it was called antisocial personality disorder, still one of those psychiatric buzzwords thrown around. And I don't know why he told me this. I just think he was trying to show off because he knew I used to play in bands and I was into the whole the rock scene and everything. So I think it was an element of that coming in. And then I wasn't friends with him, but I used to hang out with him after work. We used to go drinking and stuff like that. And he started to tell me about that other people that were like that. And they were the people in the office I just mentioned that I couldn't quite grasp there. They had a certain an essence of humanity that wasn't there. That's the best way I could describe it. You sort of got so far with their humanity and then it sort of stopped and it was like a cardboard kind of cutout behind that. And this was my sort of backstage pass into the world of pathology, psychopathology, and what back then the most common term was called sociopaths. That's kind of faded out now. Psychopath is back in big time. And it was always a kind of a background study in a way. Like if I would see a movie like, say, Hitchcock, Shadow of a Doubt, or films like that, that dealt with psychopathic subjects, it was always kind of spurred me to go and look at more information. And there wasn't a lot of information at the time. It also, as I just uncovered this information, I had read Herbie Kleckley's book, The Mask of Sanity. And then I'd read some, the odd kind of paper, research paper that came out again. And back, this is before the internet really took off. And if you wanted a university, like teaching hospital paper on psychiatric disorders, you actually had to send away and pay for them, you know, and things like that. But I didn't mind. It was very interesting. And so it was kind of a hobby, but it was kind of like, it's just trying to make sense of the world too, because I'd had this kind of baptism of fire, both in the music industry and both in the financial services industry. And so it spawned from that. And about a year and a bit ago, I started making videos about psychopathology in societies. I had encountered it. I thought there was a tremendous amount of confusion that was almost deliberately put out there to make it seem, on one hand, you had sort of this notion that psychopaths don't really exist. That's very much comes from the psychiatric end of the scale, because they don't actually fundamentally believe in concepts such as evil. Therefore, a psychopath is no more real than a leprechaun or a pixie. You understand, to the psychiatric industry. So the people who should have been dealing with psychopathology weren't. And then you have this other aspect too, where people would have a bad relationship or have a bully at work or a boss. And then they would read someone's book like Marcus Stout's The Sociopath Next Door, and they would go, he was a psychopath. And he wasn't a psychopath. It became an almost like a psychological safety valve to deal with their own, the failings of the relationship or the failings of in work and business. So there was nothing really like this on the internet at the time. Now it's everywhere, which is very strange. But I started making videos, and it was just, they were called Labyrinth of the Psychopath. And I had a plan to make the video and make the book. And then a publisher saw the videos and said, would you want, do you want to write the book for us? And that's how Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath came about. And I was quite surprised at how quickly it took off. I half expected the book, I'd write it, and it would just be almost like it would vanish into obscurity. But the exact opposite happened. It was really picked up on by people. And it suddenly, that seemed very profound for me. It was almost like there was this noetic realization that was taking root among the population, that people were understanding that there was a small percentage, quite a small percentage I use the official numbers of Europe and America, North America round off, and I got 4%. Some people say 6%. I don't know about that. Seems a bit high. Some people say 1%. And I think it's way more than 1%. But I would say that they're waking up to the fact that there's people among us who are fundamentally not us. And that's something that's only been further reinforced with my own research since then, because I've been contacted by so many people. And this staggering similarity of their stories tells me that there's something very real going on here.
Exactly right. And I think you're right to point out the way that this idea, the concept of psychopathy, has really taken off in recent years. Because even myself, a couple of years ago, I did a podcast episode exploring some of these ideas. And at the time, there was quite a lot, even a couple of years ago, but a lot less than I see now. And now I see it in things like YouTube comments and just things that I read online. More and more people are automatically associating certain behaviors with psychopathy. So I really think this idea has really taken off, and due in no small part to work of people like yourself, which I think on the whole is a good thing. But I also wonder about the backlash about this type of thing, where people start misidentifying things as psychopathy and start over-identifying with that until it becomes kind of a term that gets used up and spent. So I wonder where this is all going and why this became a meme or an idea that's implanted itself so quickly, so suddenly.
Well, firstly, regarding the sort of labeling of anyone who's not a psychopath for convenience, this is a sort of a burden that I thought long and hard about, because I didn't want to be involved in anything that could be construed as a witch hunt. So right from the get-go, I said, look, these people exist. This is not a witch hunt. This is something we have to deal with on a mature and rational level, that they still are human beings and we still have to respect their human rights. Now, until they've broken the law, and then we'll use the judicial system against that. I was very worried about vigilantism, especially with those sort of more kind of like extreme elements within the sort of like alternative community that believe in reptilians and stuff like that. I don't want any of that to infiltrate upon this kind of stuff. So it is a worrying thing, and I'm not happy about how some people are very, very eager to sort of embark upon this notion that there is we can spot them very easily. The thing is, James, you can spot them, but it's not that easy. You know, it's not, there's lots of reasons. There's lots of people who have everything from a brain damage to a stroke to on medication to a sort of almost like a malignant Asperger's or something, who are not psychopaths, but could be if you didn't know better, could be called one. You can't walk down the street and go, he's a psychopath, she's a psychopath. After all the years that I've been doing it, I still can't do it. But I can tell you one thing. You mentioned something on a video you had made there the other day, radio broadcast, where you said that even Dr. Robert Hare, after all his years, still couldn't correctly identify them. Well, the reason for that is because he's never been in a long-term personal relationship with one. If you've been in a long-term personal relationship with a psychopath and you can evaluate what that relationship was like and what it did to you, you are very, very aware of what a psychopath is, and you have a much better chance of being the kind of person who can recognize them. It's almost like a pathological baptism of fire, that you've encountered some experience that's quite unique to a human being. And, well, it's not too unique to human beings. It's a certain kind of experience. It's like a rape victim, or it's a different kind of experience like that. And the combination of that and having spent a long time with people, you can't just spend a few days with someone and make them a psychopath. You have to be up close and personal in a very close working position, or you have to be in a relationship with them, or have them in a family member or a friend. And you've noticed for a long time that these red flags were going off. Maybe then you can do it. But we cannot have a situation of people getting, he's a psychopath, she's a psychopath, because that is quite a frightening, an appalling vista we have to avoid. Because people are still, even psychopaths, are entitled to their civil rights. Now, secondly, there's the other element of this as well, where it's going to be, and it's happening, it's already happening, because the powers that be are fundamentally the expression of a psychopathic system, okay? and many of the leaders in business, politics, science, education, medicine are psychopaths. That's absolutely without a doubt. There's no doubt about that, okay? Not all of them, but the, you know, the clustering has happened towards the top because the hierarchical system that we have in the West that's, you know, been with us since 3,500 years since Babylon encourages pathology to move up the ladder at the expense of talent and anything else. So they're clustering at the top. So there is definitely, and I'm seeing it now, an element of trivializing it in the mainstream where you're going to have, where you're having sort of like, oh, well, psychopaths do exist, but they don't really exist. And half the time people are hysterical and they're pointing out where psychopaths don't exist. And the sad thing is they're often the ones who are telling the truth and because they know what they're dealing with. And I think, you know, when I see stuff like Ronson's work and stuff like that, I read that book. I only finished it last week. And it's the typical sort of like Guardian reader, progressive. I'm a progressive. And I agree with John Ronson because I'm a progressive just like him, that kind of mentality. And it's got some good stuff in it about, you know, the DSM and the over prescribing of medical conditions to individuals. There's something that's a very important thing. We can probably touch on that later on as well. But at the same time, too, it kind of seems to trivialize it when he goes on the Jon Stewart show and stuff, and you know David Letterman. Suddenly, we finally got to the point now where we can deal with psychopathology in possibly a grown-up way, and it's been thrown right back into the confusion again. And I wonder if some of that is deliberate also, because vested interests at the top are looking to have themselves protected because, you know, we're waking, you know, there's a waking up going up there. And it does concern them because they're very happy to think that, you know, people from the conspiracy movement to say things like, oh, they're reptilians. Oh, they're from the Anunnaki. Oh, they're, you know, they're this religion or this race, which, you know, then they can be accused of being racist. Then they can accuse them as being lunatics. But when you turn around and you actually say, hold on a second, you know, they're psychopaths and this is their own science. I can point out at them with, you know, 50 odd years of very well validated science. Suddenly it's a different ballgame because they don't want people to say that, because that's the one that you can actually say, well, let's put you under a CAT scan and find out. So we're playing a very risky game here, but the important thing is to keep the eye on the ball and make sure that no hysterical elements drift into this. And also no trivializing from the mass media either, because I think we really have a tool here that can help the ordinary person who may be sort of not ready to wake up to the fact that the world is basically, you know, an illusion run for a few, to actually coach them into our way of thinking, because we can say, look, they're psychopaths and this can be proven. And, you know, it's real science. We're not making things up. So we have to hold on to this, but we also have to safeguard it to make sure it isn't destroyed or used. Excuse me. And that's basically it. We have to look after the we've attained a canon of knowledge based on hard science, and we have to make sure it's not trivialized away or end up in the world of a kind of a theological hysteria.
Well, that's exactly right. And again, that's something that they love to do, is to take things that we pick up on through diligent research and finally grasp and understand, and then to use that against us by spinning it off into some ridiculous meme that can become perverted, or perversion of what the original idea really was. So that's why I'm always suspicious when people like Ronson get into muddy up the waters, and that's why I'm not going to bother to give him my money and buy the book, but I'm glad you've read it and can at least tell us. but absolutely right. Well, one of the things that fascinates me about the entire area of psychopathy is the way that the psychopaths themselves shape the system in their own image, and then the system starts to shape people in its own image. So I don't know if it's what kind of strange feedback happens there, but we definitely start to see the society becoming more and more like the individuals that are described as psychopathic. And I wonder to what extent there is the possibility for us to combat the system at a systemic level, or it has to be done at an individual level, or what does a healthy functioning society look like, and how does it respond to the psychopathic element within it?
Okay. my work is very much based on the idea of people, of first kind of reaching people who've been individually targeted by a psychopath, whether they were bullied at work or in a psychopathic relationship. And from that, scaling the experience up to the greater. So it very much plays on that idea. Look, you know, this guy you were married to for 10 years, he used to do things like change the furniture around when you come down from, you know, wake up in the morning and then tell you it was in the same position as last night. It's the same thing as the psychopath at the top who signs away all your freedom, hands your civil liberties over to nobody, to themselves, and then tells you you're more free than ever. It's that sort of the Orwellian, you know, dialect of, you know, war is peace, freedom is slavery. It's the same thing that happens on the level when you have a person who's a psychopath who's trying to get his parents' house and is putting mercury in his tea or his coffee to try and get him to sign over the lease and eventually kill him. That's the same thing as our politicians wanting to put sodium fluoride or lithium, the drinking water, so we'll hand over our society to them. We, you know, it's the old thing, as above, so below. It's the psychopathology is very much because of the predictability of the actual condition, whatever you want to call it. It can be scaled up on the greater level. Now, there's only one way to deal with a psychopath when you meet them in your life, and that's just get away from them, because you cannot reform them, you won't change them. They will never acquiesce to your desires and wishes. They will never meet you halfway. It's always a parasite and a host situation. So you get away. You have no contact with them ever again. You move on with your life and you cut all contact with them, and you make sure they have no way to get back at you. Likewise, with the system, it's the same thing. It's non-compliance. We're back to the old thing of peaceful non-compliance. We're back to the old thing of where we do not indulge with the system. Avoid it as much as possible. Do not fall for it. For starters, I don't vote anymore. I stopped voting after the Lisbon Treaty second vote. And I was even embarrassed with myself that I even voted in the second one. But I was just so angry. I was so angry that I was being told to vote twice. And then after that, I said, well, that's the end of that. I'm not voting anymore. Not until Ireland is out of the EU, at least. You don't vote. And if enough people didn't vote, the system wouldn't have the mandate to govern. Because they would, at the moment, even if 90% of the people voted for a certain issue that was against the corporate pathology control of government, they still would ignore the people. We look at the Gulf War, you know, nearly 2 million people marched in London on the eve of the second Gulf War, you know, over these fake weapons of mass destruction, and also in other cities, and they still ignored them. So people have to realize that the system will never serve them. They have to, you know, move out from the system. I'm a great believer in all kinds of local things and local solutions. I'm very much against centralization. I don't like over-centralization. I understand there's a need to, you know, maintain a society, you know, sort of administrative cohesion within a large society. But all centralization to me is the perfect tool for psychopaths to control, because all you need is one to get to the top and he owns the world. Now, so I'm a big believer in any kind of local initiatives, local farming, local food growing, local trading, bartering, anything that gets you out of their system, anything that stops you from paying as little tax into their system as possible, anything that gets you. I mean, I was just thinking there about like certain groups that managed to live outside of like Roma gypsies. They're still here after all, you know, that's after all these centuries. And they've kind of managed to live in outside Western society, but while in it. And maybe we should take a lesson from these people that they're actually onto something. It might also explain why they've been so ruthlessly and sadistically attacked by totalitarian regimes over the, you know, they're one of the first groups to be attacked by all kinds of groups, from like, you know, extreme Marxists to fascists. So maybe we should take a leaf from their page and start like pulling out a system. I basically think that if you know, the system, the psychopathic system we live in at the moment will never listen to us. Voting is just a farce at the moment. The corporations have so much control, particularly over the judicial systems. And that's really where they have us, through the court systems and things like that. The best thing is to be a socioeconomic dissident and have no contact as much as possible with them. So, you know, be independent. And just like you would be in a relationship, an abusive psychopathic relationship, be independent. And that's my, that was, that right now, that's the only thing I can see to deal with it, because we're living in a very strange time where I almost get the feeling that everything has been thrown into a washing machine or something. And there's all kinds of like crazy chaos going on around. Much of it is enforced. But I also truly believe that these elites, these like controlling families and these oligarchs at the top, they're not as clever as they like to project this image of that as being clever as they are. Like all psychopathology, there's an inherent stupidity built within it. You know, you see, because they're devious and they're cunning and they're manipulative. But that's not the same thing as being wise and clever and, you know, having foresight. So there, within them is their seized as their own destruction. And all we have to do, I believe, now, is just to sit back, look after our own lives and our own business, form our own little local communities, and let's see where this develops over the next few years. You know, that's just my opinion. But right now, until this chaos kind of finds, you know, until we're able to find that there's an actual route to this chaos they're taking us, right now the best thing is probably non-involvement and not getting too emotionally tied up in the system, because they also want you worried, terrified, angry, agitated, because that changes things. You know, the psychopaths, they're almost spooky in a way, how they learn from the time they're children that by bullying you and then being nice to you, driving you nuts and then being very generous, that it alters and changes things like the cortisol levels in your brain and various hormones. And they observe changes in people's behavior. And they know that at times of stress, and it's particularly the changing from one psychological manipulation state to the next, people are extremely vulnerable. And so that's why you'd have, you know, when Obama's election campaign was a masterclass in that, you know, first we had Bush, who was this, like, you know, this obvious, you know, like tyrant who just, you know, destroyed the Bill of Rights in the US, went to war, didn't care. And then they bring along, you know, the panacea, which was Obama. But, and then people, you know, I'm not going to knock people who voted for Obama with the best intentions, because I would have been in that boat, you know, at one time myself, because ultimately most people just want a decent life and a decent society for all. But the mind control happens when he just makes the most incredible promises and then completely ignores them. And that takes chutzpah. That's an extreme, you know, and that's what we're dealing with. People who just don't care what the masses think. So what's
exactly
the point?
And it's the incredulity of the people. I mean, how could you lie to me that much? You just couldn't. Therefore, I'll vote for you. But I don't know if people learned their lesson. I'm sure that many of them didn't, unfortunately. But I guess we'll find out this voting cycle. But as you say, I think I'm completely on board with you. I think disengagement from the system is absolutely crucial, because we make the system healthier and stronger by participating in it. So the more we can disengage from it, the less power it will ever have over us, and the less we have to worry about it overall. I think that's an extremely important point. And I wanted to bring up something that you wrote about on your blog at thomassheridanarts.blogspot.com in the last couple of months that I found it was really interesting. And it's a bit of a tangent, but I think it's a really interesting area to look at how psychopathy can affect all sorts of realms of our life that we would never really consider. And it was a piece that you wrote about the concept of gaslighting, and it related to modern art, which I've heard lots of people disparage in many ways, but I've never heard it put in this way before, so I thought it was quite interesting. Perhaps you can let people know about that.
Well, through my background within the corporate graphics world, you learn a trick. The trick is to make everything else seem pretty horrible, except the information you're trying to sell them. Okay, and that's a classic. You know, that goes right back to the sort of the Babylonian mystery schools, where they would they would fill the streets with light, and then they would bring people in and produce complex rituals, and then they would go back to their dull, drab lives. But they had been so emotionally impacted by these rituals using lights and colors that it would entrench in their psyche or in their psychology and make them sort of more devoted to the priest class and stuff like that. That's the oldest trick in the book. Now, the psychopathic control grid, as I call it, has now flipped that around the other way. And it's always in development of technology, along with the technology. We had all my life, and it's going back now 100 years, when you go into art galleries, even when I was a little kid, I was always amazed by just how stupid modern art is. A picture of a plank with a piece of paint on it, a rolled up newspaper thrown in the corner. Now, this is not a new thing. This was going on when I was a little boy. This is not new. And it started with the Dadaist movement, which was sort of a rebellion against the carnage of World War One. And in many ways, it started as a sort of a way for people who just knew the world was insane to try and get away from it. But like everything else, the controllers then begin to see a use for it. And as things like very good quality color advertising and stuff was coming along, they had to make sure that their products and their advertising look better than the artwork in the galleries. So gaslighting is when you change, is a term used for when psychopaths change a person's sense of reality by changing their sort of like psychological goalposts or their baseline to accept a new norm as reality, even if it flies in the face of what their heart and soul and mind is telling them. And modern art, I'm absolutely convinced of it now, has been used to make advertising outside the art galleries look more appealing. You go to somewhere like the Tate Modern in London or the Guggenheim in New York, and you're walking around and you're seeing these absurd installations, you know, by all these young geniuses who just seem to all come from very connected families. I would find that very interesting too. And you walk around these minimalist spaces, actually minimalism, you know, you walk around these spaces, white walls. It's all very sterile. It's all very cold. It's all very superficial and obnoxious and pseudo, you know, pseudo intellectual. And then by the time you get out of these places, you stand outside and you see a big advertisement for a McDonald's and you want a Big Mac. Just because it's providing an antidote to the blandness, because we're, especially today, because, you know, people forget that there wasn't really color in the world prior to 100 years ago. Pigments and stuff like that were not as easily available. People lived in a more sort of a rustic and pastoral world in the Victorian age than they did when the invention of mass printing and color television and, you know, billboards came about. So they had to make that stuff more appealing. And the way to do that was to degenerate art. And by gaslighting the public with this notion of a new art, advertising becomes more appealing. And you have Charles Saatchi, who's the main modern art dealer, owns one of the biggest advertising guys in the world. He's the one who discovered, you know, Damien Hirst and Tracy Eam and all these other people, and fills his galleries full of, you know, cardboard boxes that are all stamped on and stuff like that. And he also happens to own one of the biggest advertising companies in the world. So, you know, it's very clever, it's very devious, and if anyone can find a better explanation to why the modern art scene is ridiculous, I'd like to hear it, but I think, hey, that's the only one that makes sense to me at this point.
I agree. I mean, it does make sense. Exactly. Well, it makes so much sense when you put it in those terms that I don't think I ever would have arrived at that conclusion. But it really does seem like that must be the case. And I think the implications of that must be for many different corners of our society and culture, as everything gets dumbed down so that whatever they present to us seems that much better than it would if we were all actually functioning at a level where we could appreciate what true beauty is, what true art is, what true writing is, what true culture might actually look like. So it does, I think, really have profound implications there. Very interesting. And I believe you prefaced the article that you wrote about that, the blog post, by saying that, was it your niece who had gone into art college with these beautiful paintings and come out with this atrocious modern art monstrosity?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If you, I had the, you know, I've heard this constant story of very talented people going into art college, promising careers as a beautiful illustrator, pound up, and then, you know, these sort of like bearded schizoids in the art schools, these professors would have them nailing a palette together and putting a bird's feather on and saying it has something to do with climate change. It's all about the concept. And again, it's propaganda too. That's another aspect of this as well. This sort of like superficial sort of, I don't want to get back to knocking the Guardian again, but this notion that like everything had that kind of progressive notion that everything has to have this sort of like smug, self-satisfied resonance of, you know, I'm doing the right thing here because I'm one of the progressive people. And so that's, you know, my art represents, you know, the ice caps melting or, you know, the you know, the banking system in Venezuela in the 1940s, and here's a broken egg box to prove it. And there's a lot of that going on as well. And people are just like watching TV, and they're watching the Turner Prize, especially, you know, one of the nominees for the Turner Prize this year is a rolled up piece of paper. And it has some kind of silly con, and people are like ringing their heads. And it's been going on since I've been at the, and you've seen it all your life too as well. It's been going on forever. People saying, what is this rubbish? You know, well, it's not rubbish. It's a carefully crafted science of psychological manipulation, and it's good for business. And that's what it's really ultimately all about. Everything is money.
Exactly. Yeah. And as you point out, a lot of the people who succeed in this modern art tend to come from well-connected families. So there's always that aspect to it as well. Interesting. Very interesting. But obviously, psychopathy is something that you've written and talked about quite a lot. But being in Europe right now, this is just such an incredible time to be in Europe, and not in a good way, I suppose, with the collapse of the Eurozone and the atrocity that was committed against the Irish people in the second Lisbon vote and all of this stuff that we've been seeing unfold for the last few years. Perhaps you can give us an update as to what you think is really happening in Europe right now, and where you think this is all starting to play out into. Do you think that we are going to see the collapse of the system, or is it an engineered collapse in order to make the system even more centralized and in the hands of the predators?
Well, nothing would make me happier than to see the EU vanish. It is a supersized Weimar Republic at this point. It certainly doesn't represent any kind of notion of democracy or anything like that. You have an unelected commission who's basically passing laws by the second, literally at this point. And it's going to lead to radical extremism in Europe, just like the same way the Weimar Republic led to radical extremism in Europe back in the 1930s. It's going to happen again. People are being deliberately pushed to the edges. This whole thing of the Eurozone collapse, I'm almost convinced now it's a piece of theatre. It's not based on anything real. It's based on press releases coming from the ECB and the European Commission sent out there to give this notion that Europe is in crisis so they can have this 12th hour thing to save Europe. Now, what makes me believe that is, now, it's very interesting. Ireland was actually once a very pro-European, pro-EU country. That's changed radically in recent months. I know people that used to laugh at me 2 years ago and call me a flat earth or whatever for pointing out that the EU is basically going to erode all our civil rights. I can remember on the eve of the Lisbon Treaty second vote, with this member of it, a youth member, he was about 35 at least, of one of these political parties here that was pushing for the EU thing, for the yes vote. And he was so smarmy and smug. It was really obnoxious. He was like, oh, what are you talking about? That's not going to happen. As soon as this happens, they'll arrange the banking bailouts. Everything will be fine. And then I was saying, have you even read the Lisbon Treaty? No. But there was posters. Back to the Arc thing again. The posters for the Lisbon Treaty were incredible. The no posters were dull and boring. The yes posters had words like yes, 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 like you were having a sexual orgasm if you were actually voting for the Lisbon Treaty. And all this NLP and mind control was flying left, right, and center. And of course, people, because they don't have a sort of a psychological barrier towards this sort of pathological symbolism, they're so easily controlled, even the most intelligent ones. So anyway, so I noticed the EU was a big mind game at that point, and it has only gotten worse. And I watched this thing at first and I was saying, oh, here we go, maybe we are going to go down. But then you notice something very interesting in tandem with this that goes on in the newspapers. On one hand, we're being told that the EU is about to go, and people are suddenly saying, yeah, let it die, we'll default on our loans and we'll go back to having the Irish pound, and we'll be a proper country again that can set our own interest rates. And people were like, yeah, let's do it. Damn the consequences. It can't be any worse than it is now. At the same time, the very same journalists who are writing about how we have to vote for the yes vote, suddenly the newspapers are full of stories of, oh, could you imagine what would happen if we leave the EU? It'll be like the famine again. Oh, it'll be horrible. And then suddenly the people who had got a bit of guts and a bit of balls and were ready to actually move on something are suddenly like, oh, mortgage interest would go up 100%. You know, and there's lots of this kind of stuff. The same journalists who are flown out during the run up to the EU, the EU Lisbon Treaty second vote, who were college professors. This is one of the things that people, I want to make sure your listeners know about this. On the eve of the Lisbon Treaty second vote, there was non-stop flights between every airport in Ireland and Strasbourg filled with college professors, intellectuals, the intelligentsia, the media, and especially newspaper journalists who were being wined, dined, and treated like princes with their entire families put up in first-class hotels by the EU so they would come back and sell the propaganda. And this is how it's done. And the media are so bought and paid for, especially in this country. I have no faith in any of the media here. When I see a so-called economics editor from a major newspaper appearing on the TV news here and saying things like, Irish taxpayers are going to have to get used to putting another $2 billion into the Bank of Ireland, as if it's some kind of natural law of the universe that we just keep throwing taxpayers' money into these failing banks. And there's no other alternative to discuss. This is the reality. This is how the world works. And this is how the EU is doing the same thing with the currency crisis. It's a piece of, I bet nothing will come from this. I bet we'll still have the euro. I mean, I'd love to be wrong, but I think we'll have the euro probably, and we'll have more control of national economies. They're already talking about a referendum here where basically we'd hand over the last vestige of our economic sovereignty to Europe, because it would help solve the currency crisis. And it's not only happening in Ireland, it's happening in Italy, and it's happening in Spain as well. They're very clever, very devious, and because they don't have to worry about, because the EU Commission doesn't have to worry about running for election, they can just sit back and be pure, it's the return of realpolitik. They can be pure politicians, they can be the political animals they've always longed to be. And that's why they specifically source out former finance ministers and people like that from the various countries in order to put on the commission, because they know that the people, that if they don't have to deal with the actual issue of democracy, they'll get the job done, because they're so driven to make a name for themselves politically. So I would love to see the EU die. I would love to see the euro gone. I would love to see all the national currencies and interest rates back, but I can't see it happening, James. It's too Disneylander at this point. It's like taking the terminal child to Disneyland. You know, it almost feels like that. I can't ever see it happening.
Well, I'm afraid you're right, and I think you're right to point out all those people who are getting excited about the idea. Well, yeah, let's just let it go. Let's get out of it. Let's take back our sovereignty, and then they can easily be led right back to the same spot by the same prostitutes who just led them there in the first place. So it's a very disheartening in that respect. But what's your overall sense of the people in Ireland right now? I mean, obviously they must be demoralized about the entire EU project and how it hasn't worked out for them. But how about in other aspects of the New World Order system and about psychopathy and other of these issues? Do you think people are receptive to this type of thing right now, or not on the whole?
I'd say it's just the same as everywhere else. There's a general apathy among the population. There, as long as the soccer, the rugby, and X Factor's on TV, most people don't really care. Once their mortgage is being paid, and you know, even though people are defaulting on their mortgage, it's not happening to a huge degree like it happened in the United States. A lot of the people who've been hurt have been the rich. But there's tremendous apathy. You have all these bankers and these property developers who are directly responsible for bankruptcy in the country, and not one of them will ever be arrested and put in jail. It just won't happen. It won't happen. This country doesn't work like that. We only put poor people in jail. I'm sure it's the same in most, you know, it seems to be the same in most Western countries. But the rich and the wealthy, no matter what they do, they walk. So Irish people have this sort of this culturally entrenched sort of apathy where they say, oh, they're all gangsters. And in some ways, it's a healthy mentality, because we're good at that. We're good at like recognizing, you know, we're not naive in the sense that we were seduced by a politician so much, but we because of our history and because of things like the colonialism and things like, you know, prior to that, things like the penal laws. Irish people are very well. You'd have to really hold a gun to their heads to stop them from voting because of our, you know, many of us, our grandparents grandmothers and grandfathers actually had to take up guns to win them. You know, that's still a very strong resonance within the Irish psyche. You know, it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't that the times of Michael Collins and all that stuff. That was only 80 odd years ago. It wasn't 200 or 300 years ago. And, you know, all our grandparents and great grandparents were there, you know, so, you know, that's still a very strong resonance within the Irish psyche, which also has to be controlled, because we can't have a situation where we had that in 1966 and all of a sudden it gave birth to provisional IRA. So again, it's a loaded dice. We have to be very careful about extremism. It's that balance. I can't see that ever happening in Ireland, not in my lifetime. There's a tremendous apathy. However, I will say that the people who are what we call the awakened community here are surprisingly well organized. I know all the guys from Sovereign Independent and all that, you know, and these guys are really they're smart guys who know what they're doing and have a specific drive. And we have a couple of radio stations and stuff like that. So there is a buzz. It is there and it is real. And it is good people that are behind it. And there are, being Irish, there are factions within that too, unfortunately, you know, it just the nature of our culture, whatever, you know, you always say that the first thing on the agenda of any meeting set up by Irish people is when do we split. And there's a lot of truth to that, you know. So but sometimes that's actually quite a healthy thing as well, because it always creates cynicism and it always creates apathy. It's when you have a totalitarianism works best when everyone has the same, when everyone's on board the same thing. So maybe that's not such a bad thing either. So yeah, the awakened community here is tiny, but it's got its stuff together. It's not amateurish. It's not hysterical, and it's not it has promise. And if things keep going the way they're going, it's only going to get stronger and better. So that's why I'm positive for the future. In terms of that, will there be any? I mean, I've heard people saying we're going to have civil, you know, we're going to have disruptions here, and we're going to have like civil disorder and chaos. That's a long way, long, long way down the road. People have become very middle class here and very comfortable. And it's not like, you know, 50 or 60 or even 30 years ago where, you know, people would like, you know, leave the towns and the cities and the countryside and like go and riot. Those days are over for now. But anything can happen in the future. That's the way I look at it.
It's certainly true. And as this year continues to develop, I hope that we'll be in touch with you about what's happening in Ireland, a very interesting spot on the globe these days. So absolutely fascinating conversation in so many ways. If people are interested in getting a copy of Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath, what's the best way for them to get their hands on a copy of the book?
It's available everywhere, but it's on sale on most of the Amazon sites. So you get it from Amazon or any online book retailers, or if you don't want to deal with credit cards, you can get it from your local bookshop. If they don't have it there, just give them the, you know, the number and the name, and they'll order it for you. And so it's easy enough to get.
And as I mentioned, you're working on a forthcoming follow-up to that work, Defeated Demons. When do you expect that will be out?
It's actually, the manuscript has gone to the publishers now. We're aiming at March 1st. It's going to be Puzzling People Part 2. I'll be covering things that we missed out in the first book, like aging psychopaths and the New Age movement psychopath, the guru leader psychopath, as well as a more sort of philosophical insight into how we deal with these things in a personal level, in our own life and in society. Almost to try and, I want to take the hysteria out of this and push it more towards mature reflection. It's also going to be a warning that, like, we can't let the alternative journalists from the media take ownership of this issue, because they will bury it.
Absolutely. Well, that sounds like a very, very important book, so I'm looking forward to it, and I hope we can have you on to talk about it once it gets published. So absolutely, great conversation. Well, Thomas Sheridan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you very much, Damon. The best to you and your listeners. Thank you.